Good morning. It is good to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to come and speak before you all. You have heard that the ancients were told, "You shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever says to his brother, 'You good for nothing,' shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be guilty enough to go into fiery hell. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering." We'll return to that text a little later, Matthew 5, verses 21 through 24. But this morning I want to go back to the beginning, go back to the first murder that was ever committed in Genesis chapter 4, the story of Cain and Abel. I want to consider the story of Cain and Abel and just what is going on there. We're going to talk about what happens in the story and a lot of the questions that are very difficult, if not impossible, to answer. And then we will consider the significance of Cain and Abel as example characters of sorts. And we'll conclude with a question. Am I Cain or am I Abel? Kind of an application thought. You want to follow along in your Bibles in Genesis chapter 4. The context of our story, God has made the heavens and the earth. God has made a man and a woman and placed them in the garden to cultivate it and to keep it. God had one rule in that garden: do not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which humankind subsequently broke. The woman was deceived by the evil serpent. The man likewise ate the fruit. They broke the one rule, and God, in response, placed curses on them. God placed a curse on the serpent, promising perpetual conflict between the serpent's offspring and the woman's. God also multiplied the woman's pain in childbirth, in childbearing, and the man's pain in toiling the ground, and condemns them both to death. "You are dust, to dust you shall return." And the man and the woman, Adam and Eve, are banished from the garden because God does not want them to eat from the tree of life and live forever. But the story does not end there, thankfully. Instead, we get to Genesis 4. And in Genesis 4, it says that the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, "I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord." Again, she gave birth to his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and for his offering he had no regard. So Cain became very angry, and his countenance fell. And then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it." Cain told Abel, his brother. And it came about when they were in the field, Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Two brothers. One's named Cain, the other's named Abel. The name Cain means gotten one or created one. It's not the same word for create that is used in Genesis 1, but it is a term sometimes used of God creating things. And by giving birth, Eve says, "You know, I've made this child with the help of the Lord." It is Adam's son, but God gets the credit. The name Abel means futility. It means nothing. It's actually the same word if you've read Ecclesiastes, where the writer is saying vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. That's the word there, which is Abel's name. The text doesn't explain why he is named this, except to foreshadow perhaps what is coming. Abel becomes nothing because he is killed by Cain. Cain is a farmer. Abel is a shepherd. Contrasting occupations. The two brothers come to worship the Lord, to offer sacrifices. I don't know where they got the idea to offer sacrifices. Somebody told them, maybe. Maybe God told them. Cain and Abel offer gifts that correspond to their professions. Cain offers from the fruit of the ground, which, you know, since he's a farmer, that's what he produces. And Abel offers from the firstlings of his flock, the sheep that he takes care of. This is the first time in the Bible that sacrifices are even mentioned at all. There's little in the text about instructions for such things. Well, when you think about, oh, maybe the Israelites are reading this later after the fact, that's just kind of assumed knowledge there. I remember one time I was reading this, my wife asked me, well, had fire even been discovered yet? This is a kind of a, you know, this is so early on in the Bible story. The text is written to a community already steeped in the language of sacrifice, so the explanation is not needed for them. And then we find out, well, God regarded one offering, God accepted one offering, and God rejected another. What does that even look like? And the answer is, well, I don't really know what that even looks like. Did God say something to them? He's pretty talkative in these chapters. Did some visible sign take place? Some people suggest that God actually answered with fire from heaven for Abel and not for Cain. I don't know. The text confronts us with more questions than answers, as it is very common to do if you've read the early chapters of Genesis. God accepts Abel's offering and rejects Cain's. Why? Oh, well, the suggestions are many, many, many suggestions for why God rejects Cain's offering. Does God just like shepherds more than farmers? Is it just purely arbitrary, God working in mysterious ways? Does God prefer animal sacrifice to vegetable? Well, I mean, he accepts fruit offerings and grain offerings elsewhere in the Old Testament. Perhaps the most common suggestion, and the thing that I think most likely, although, is that God prefers Abel because, well, the one contrasting statement made that Cain offered some of the fruit of the ground while Abel offered the firstlings of his flock, the firstborn of his flock, and the fat portions. And anytime else in the Bible you read about sacrifice, people offer their firstborn animals, they offer their fat portions or their best portions, and they offer their first fruits. But Cain does not offer his first fruits despite being the firstborn son. It is Abel who offers the firstborn of his flock. Regardless of what you think about that, though, we recall the New Testament commentary on this in Hebrews chapter 11. In Hebrews chapter 11, why is Cain rejected and Abel accepted? Well, by faith. Hebrews 11 verse 4, by faith Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts. And through faith, although he is dead, he still speaks. But that doesn't really answer the reason why his sacrifice was better. It just simply, other than that, it was offered through faith. Cain would eventually kill his own brother because, as the reading this morning said in 1 John chapter 3, that his brother's deeds were evil and Abel's were righteous. Faith is expressed in offering the best of what we have to offer, and Cain does not do that. His devotion is half-hearted. He expresses piety, yes, but not priority. His firstborn son does not offer first fruits. So God shows up, and God talks to Cain. Now, wouldn't that be handy? Have God come and speak to you personally whenever something goes wrong so that he can kind of dissect what went wrong. Why the long face, Cain? Why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, don't you know you'll be lifted up? What does that mean? Does that mean that Cain will be forgiven? Does that mean that he'll feel better? Does that mean that his offering will be accepted? I don't know. And what does doing well mean? What is Cain supposed to do well? And then we get this warning. If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Sin. Sin wants Cain. Desire. It's a very unusual term, desire. The only other time in Genesis it's used is in Genesis 3 in verse 16, when it tells the woman that your desire will be for your husband, but he will rule over you. But now sin desires Cain, desires to rule him. But Cain must rule over it. Sin is depicted like a wild animal, or perhaps a demon, crouching at the door, waiting to pounce on him. The door to what? Is it like Cain is about to get ambushed or something? Sin is seen as this aggressive force that's going to take over and destroy everything. Well, it's bigger than Cain. It takes on a life of its own to bring about death. This is what the problem is. Cain has become angry. And in this situation where Cain has become angry at the altar of the Lord, offering his gift, he has something against his brother. What must he do now? He must do well. A lot of people don't do well with anger. Anyone can feel angry. Anyone can feel bad. You know, you can have situations in life where, you know, something bad happens and you feel a certain way. But God expects Cain to do something better with his feelings than to just do the easy thing, the natural thing. But what winds up happening? Well, Cain does not control his actions. Instead, Cain winds up being controlled by his anger. And just as it was the fruit of the tree that led to the downfall of Adam and Eve, well, Cain offers fruit of the ground, and now it leads to his downfall. Cain's anger gets the better of him, and rather than be reconciled to his brother, he kills him. In verse 8, Cain told Abel, his brother. Cain said to Abel, his brother. Some versions actually will add, you know, Cain said to his brother, let's go out into the field. They go out into the field, and Cain kills Abel. What started out as an act of worship ends in bloodshed and murder. The first death in the Bible, you know, when you read Genesis 3 and it says, to dust you shall return, you think that the first death is in the Bible is going to be natural causes, but it's not. Somebody gets murdered first. Man and woman striving to gain immortality, barred from the tree of life, but the firstborn brings the reality of death into the world. That is not how an offering to the Lord is supposed to end. What good is devotion to the Lord? You know, what good is Cain offering the fruit of the ground? Even if it had been the first fruits of the ground, what good would that have been if he would immediately destroy the one worshiping alongside of him? You think your worship is unacceptable now, Cain? Well, just wait. And then, as if the story didn't throw enough unanswered questions at us, we have a conversation between God and Cain now. And this conversation is quite perplexing. Let's start in verse 9. The Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And he said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" He said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. Now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you. You will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is too great to bear. Behold, you have driven me this day from the face of the ground. And from your face I will be hidden, and I will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." So the Lord said to him, "Therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain, so that no one finding him would slay him. And then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Now, do you have a few questions after reading that? Because I do. Just a few. It starts out with something familiar. God asks Cain, "Hey, where's Abel?" And it kind of sounds like the conversation that God's having with Adam and Eve in Genesis 3. "Where are you?" Like God doesn't know. "Did you eat the fruit I told you not to?" Like God doesn't know. It's the familiar scene. If you're a parent and you have kids and they've done something bad, you had some of the same conversations with them. "Did you take those cookies?" I know full well. I don't know whether they took them or not. I want to see if they'll own up to it. Cain's "I don't know." "Where is your brother?" "I don't know." Verse 9. Is that "I don't know" is a straight up lie. He knows exactly where Abel is. Abel is where he left the body. "Am I my brother's keeper?" "Am I my brother's keeper?" Now, if you just pretend for a minute, you know, that we hadn't even read the verses, the 8 verses preceding it. "Am I my brother's keeper?" And you can see where he's coming from, right? I mean, a keeper, it's a custodian, it's a guard. Abel was a keeper of flocks. Cain is like, "Well, Abel's not my sheep. I'm not his shepherd. I don't have to keep him." You think of it like a, you know, a zookeeper. I can't be expected to keep track of his movements all day. That's not fair. But we know context, and we know that this is a deceptive answer, and we know that Cain is deliberately exaggerating his own responsibilities in order to deny them entirely. Adam and Eve respond to God's questions with fear and guilt and blame in Genesis 3, but in Genesis 4, Cain is responding to it, well, with a sort of a brashness, sort of an arrogance, sort of an impudence, a stubbornness, a double down. Cain's problem isn't that he shirks responsibility, it's that he's rationalizing his wickedness. And God exposes the deceitfulness of his answer. You say you don't know, but I hear your brother's blood. It's crying out to me from the ground. The law of Moses would later have a lot to say about the idea that innocent blood shed defiles the ground on which it is shed, that it cries out for vengeance. And there are various laws designed to keep the blood of the innocent from contaminating everybody in the land. In Deuteronomy 21, there's this whole business about how, if a person is found dead in the field and they don't know who did it, they have to measure and find out the distance to the closest city so that they can atone for the death of the innocent, because innocent blood defiles the ground on which it is shed. Psalm 9 and verse 12, he who requires blood remembers them. He does not forget the cry of the afflicted. And of course, you know, as we'll find later on after the flood, God tells Noah that whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. There's a sort of a vengeance statement that is being made about the bloodshed of the innocent. But knowing all of that, and the people who read Genesis for the first time would have known that about this requirement for blood vengeance, and you expect Abel to be avenged, and the surprising thing that happens is no vengeance is taken for Abel. Cain is not killed. Cain does not die in this story. Cain gets a slap on the wrist, or more appropriately, on the green thumb that he had. Well, you can't farm anymore. Which, I mean, is bad, I guess. That was his livelihood. But it doesn't seem quite equitable. You are more cursed than the ground. You are cursed from the ground. The only other character in the story to have the curse placed on him directly was the serpent, up to this point. Originally, God had only cursed the ground on account of Adam, but now Cain will not get any crops at all. Cain's profession has been revoked. The farmer will never farm again. But even more bizarre than that, you know, Cain's getting off easy. I think he's getting off easy. Is what Cain says, that's too much. My punishment is too great to bear. It's too much. Somebody might kill me. Just that statement alone was like, wait, what, there's other people on the earth, apparently. I don't know when, how, exactly. The text is not telling us. It's not giving us these details. Is he worried people are going to recognize him as a murderer? Is he worried that being a wanderer will make him isolated and vulnerable? But the brashness of this, the condemned complains to God. Why does the condemned complain to God? Humans haven't changed much. It's somebody else's fault. It's too much to bear. Abel's punishment wasn't too much to bear in Cain's sight. His only crime was offering a better sacrifice than his brother. But Cain's punishment, too much to bear. The killer fears to be killed. And then, shockingly, God makes this concession in verse 15. That whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And he appoints a sign on Cain. We don't know what the sign for Cain is, and there's a thousand different suggestions that have been proposed for that. But it's designed to protect him. And the big question isn't what was the sign that God put on Cain. The big question is, why in the world does God spare Cain? Is God just fickle? Does he just sort of play wishy-washy on his punishments? What's going on here? He lets Adam and Eve live instead of killing them right away. He protects Cain from vengeance by threatening sevenfold vengeance. I mean, we sometimes talk about the natural consequences for sin. You know, instead of God striking somebody with a bolt of lightning, he just sort of lets life get them. But he doesn't even let that happen to Cain, because he says, well, anyone who kills Cain will have sevenfold vengeance come on him. Anyone who kills Cain basically gets struck by lightning. What? Why? Is it because Cain didn't know that murder was wrong? Some have said that. Is it because God lets tares grow among the wheat until the time of the harvest? Is it a matter of deferred judgment? We know, of course, that Cain's line eventually does get destroyed, but it takes several generations. Is God graciously protecting the sinner as well as the victim? If there's grace for Cain, who is there not grace for? Is there grace for me? And that's where the Cain and Abel story leaves us. Lots of questions, few answers. Why let Abel die? Why let Cain live? Why protect Cain but not Abel? Why let the wanderer settle? Why let the killer live? Why let the obvious bad guy in the story get away with it? We say Cain became a wanderer, but the first thing he does is he goes and builds a city. To find any kind of resolution to this, we have to look further ahead, which raises the second point I want to talk about. Cain and Abel are more than just two brothers. Cain and Abel are archetypes, we'll say, so symbolic characters in their own right. They're sort of the model for two kinds of people to come. What can they teach us? What can Abel teach us? Well, Abel is the first person in the Bible to die, and there seems to be no good reason for it. When Jesus wants to talk about the righteous blood that had been shed on the earth, what example does Jesus reach for? He reaches for Abel. In Matthew chapter 23, in verses 29 through 36, when he's really landing some blows on the Pharisees, he says, well, Matthew 23, 29 through 36, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had been living in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers, you serpents, you brood of vipers. How will you escape the sentence of hell? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, so that upon you may fall the blood, well, the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." The Pharisees and the religious leaders who had the audacity to say, "Well, if we'd been alive back then, we wouldn't have acted that way." Jesus sees this as historical arrogance. Decorating the tombs of the prophets means nothing if you're going to murder your generation of prophets. Decrying the injustices of the past is no good if you're going to do the same thing in the present. And the other guy that Jesus mentions, well, he mentions Abel as Exhibit A, and he mentions Zechariah, I guess that's Exhibit Z. Zechariah, murdered between the temple and the altar. Probably a reference to 2 Chronicles chapter 24. Zechariah was a prophet who stood up to the king when the king was going after idols. And rather than heed the prophet's warning, the king had him killed. And as with Cain and Abel, the altar of worship became ground zero for another murder. Abel's blood speaks even now. A man whose name meant nothing and who could have been easily forgotten is remembered and heard by God. And what's more, Abel's blood cries out in the same way as the blood of all of the innocent sufferers of this world, right up to the present day, up to and including Jesus, whose sprinkled blood speaks better than the blood of Abel, as it says in Hebrews 12:24. And so in some ways, we might rightly say that Abel is a prototype Christ who dies innocently and unjustly because of the sins of somebody else. Now let's talk about Cain. What can Cain teach us? Well, Cain is also the first person in the Bible to kill. And there's no good reason for that either. And throughout the Bible, we meet people who kill their own brothers, or who try to kill their, who try to kill their own brothers. Wicked men. Esau conspires to kill his brother Jacob. Joseph's brothers conspire to kill him. Abimelech, Judges 9. Absalom, 2 Samuel 13. Jehoram, 2 Chronicles 21. Men who kill their brothers are consistently the bad guys in the Bible story. And Cain's legacy in the New Testament is universally negative. He is the prototype brother killer. He is the pattern for the false teachers in Jude 11 alongside Korah and Balaam. Genesis 3 taught us to be on the lookout that there's enmity between the seed of woman and the seed of the serpent. But lo and behold, Cain is the seed of the serpent. That doesn't mean he had serpent DNA in his cells. But spiritually speaking, he is very much of the devil. And this is the point of the reading at the beginning this morning in 1 John chapter 3. In 1 John chapter 3, in verses 10 through 12, by this the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor the one who does not love his brother. For this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the evil one, and slew his brother. And for what reason did he slay him? Because his deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous. Like Abel, Cain is a pattern too. Cain is a pattern for those who come after him. And if Abel is a prototype Christ, I submit, to borrow another term from John, that Cain is a prototype antichrist. Cain is a son of the devil, a killer, a man of lawlessness, a father of wickedness, who went on to build the first great city in this world. He cannot express remorse or guilt, but only grumbles about how his punishment is too much to bear. Cain is very much the prototype of every bad guy you meet in the Bible story. From the older brother in the prodigal son story who stands in the field and is upset because his dead brother has come back to life, as his father puts it, to the rich man who cries out from torment, "My punishment is too great to bear," and who has the audacity to ask Lazarus, who unjustly suffered at his gate, "Oh, can you come cool my tongue and heal my suffering?" That's who Cain is. So we see who Abel is, and we see who Cain is, and we see how history has a lot of Cains and Abels in it, but it confronts us with some questions about God's mercy. Does God show mercy to the Cains of this world? And the surprising answer is yes, for now. And does God notice the Abels of this world, the people who perish and suffer unjustly? And the answer is yes, God does see, and God will come to judge the world. Because just as Cain murdered over what was on the altar, well, we learn that the souls under the altar cry out for vengeance still, even now. In Revelation chapter 6 and verses 9 and through 11, John writes, "When the Lamb broke the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth?' And there was given to each of them a white robe, and they were told that they should rest for a little while longer, until the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed, even as they had been, would be completed also." And this is where we have to ask the question, am I Cain or am I Abel? This is where we come now to the third bit I wanted to talk about, the application, the question, am I Cain or am I Abel? And that question brings us back to our beginning text in Matthew chapter 5. What do we do when we are offering our gift at the altar and we feel anger? Jesus' warning invokes the image of the Cain and Abel story a little bit. Like Cain getting angry at the altar, we are called to reconcile and not to destroy. You might do well. If you do well, will you not be lifted up? Will not things be better? If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Okay, wait a second, though. I can't possibly be Cain, can I? I've never killed anybody, and I've certainly never killed anybody over something that happened in church, right? So how can I be Cain? I'm not that bad. But look again at what Jesus says in Matthew 5, because it's about so much more than just the physical act of murder. Yes, Cain is an extreme. But Jesus gets into anger here and what people do with anger and what people say with anger. You've heard that the ancients were told you shall not commit murder. That's the bare minimum. You know, whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you, what? You're angry with your brother? You say to your brother, good for nothing? You call your brother, you fool? There's guilt. guilt enough to go into fiery hell. That's scary. Now we're talking about anger. Now we're talking about a feeling. Now we're talking about insults. Ever insult somebody? Have I ever insulted somebody? Well, I can think of a few times. More than a few. Okay, I probably dished them out quite a bit now that I think about it. Have I ever been angry with somebody? Oh, well, I can start thinking about all kinds of times where I've done that, right? And so now it starts to look kind of bad. Cain didn't master his feelings, and in the end, that's what destroyed his brother. The pages of the Bible are littered with people who destroyed themselves and who destroyed other people because they did not handle their emotions well. They weren't honest about what they were feeling. They weren't able to step outside of the situation and look at it with realism, and they weren't able to give consideration for others. The Bible calls us to be more mature than that. The law says to love the Lord your God with all of our heart and our mind and our souls. Do we have a good grasp on our hearts? If we do not, we will fail here. And so the real pointed question to ask is, well, how do we feel about our brethren? Do we love them? Are we happy for them? Are we happy with them? Are we proud of them? Are we comforted by them? Do we rejoice with them when they rejoice? Do we weep with them when they weep? Sometimes brethren make us feel sad. Sometimes brethren make us angry. Sometimes brethren frustrate us and disappoint us, make us fearful, make us jealous. And I'll be honest, I have felt at some point in my life all of those things at fellow church members. And I know what it feels like to come into an assembly to worship with the weight of anger or fear or anxiety with some of the people I'm going to be in the room with worshiping God with. And I will tell you, that pollutes my devotion to God. When we stand at the altar to offer our gift and that's eaten away at us, we come before the Lord to offer the sacrifice of praise, that'll eat us up on the inside. That's why Jesus says what he does. If you are presenting your offering at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, you put that on hold. You leave your offering there before the altar and go. How do we handle these feelings of anger, frustration, and difficulty? And one of the biggest temptations we might have is, well, to do nothing. And that isn't what Jesus prescribes. What Jesus says here about how we can be at the altar and remember a conflict with our brethren, then it falls on us personally to go and do something about it. And here's, of course, the great question, well, you know, is it the person who did the sinning or is it the person who was sinned against who has that obligation? And the answer is yes. Yes. Yes, you both have that obligation. I love how Matthew 5 words it one way, your brother has something against you. But then Matthew 18:15, when Jesus talks about going and showing your brother his fault in private, now it's your brother who has sinned. And so the answer is, well, who does it fall on? Well, it falls on me personally. That's who it falls on, to take the initiative. Brotherly love is not a quibble about who should take the initiative to reconcile the relationship. Brotherly love means that reconciliation should be a race to see who does it first. And I tell you, I mean, it could be true. Well, maybe I think my brother has something against me. Maybe I think there's just something off kilter in the relationship. Don't avoid the real talk. Don't be the one that leaves things unsaid that need to be said. Talk to them, not with anger or with insults, you fool, you good for nothing, but with love, with concern for reconciliation. Do well so that you will be lifted up. Okay. But you ever have this happen? I tried talking to them, and it blew up in my face. That ever happened to you? That happens to me. Instead of bottling up my anger, I unleashed it, and I became Cain. My worst fears were realized. I got unloaded on and beat up, and I became Abel. Nothing. And that's why we need the Cain and Abel story. We need the Cain and Abel story to remind us that God has grace for the Cains of this world. Because at some point, I have been Cain. And at some point, you have been Cain. And at some point, I have been Abel, and you've probably been Abel. And when that happens, we have to remember the thing that Cain forgot. This person you want to be reconciled with is your brother or your sister, your family. And you ought to love them. You share a family with them. So act as out of love. Don't be like Cain, who was of the evil one and slew his brother. Don't be like Cain, who makes excuses and who comes up with reasons why he didn't do anything wrong. Don't be like Cain, who can only gripe and whine about the consequences, but can't see the devastating pain he has inflicted on others. The New Testament ethic doesn't sound like Cain. It sounds like Abel. It sounds like Abel when Jesus says, why not turn the other cheek? It sounds like Abel when Paul says, why not rather be wronged? If I got to choose who I'm going to be, I should be Abel. But more to the point, I should strive for reconciliation and love. And then we ask ourselves the question, well, which one was Jesus? Well, the cross says it all, where Jesus stands in that story. And it looks like Jesus was defeated, innocent victim, another Abel, another nothing. But lo and behold, God vindicated Jesus. And God will vindicate Abel. And God will someday vindicate all who have suffered unjustly. Let me conclude this morning. And I guess it's customary to end a sermon with an invitation of sorts. So here's the invitation to think about our relationships with one another. Have we come to the altar this morning remembering that our brother or sister has something against us, remembering that we have something against them? Is it eating you up inside? Here's the warning. Sin crouches at the door, but you can do well and rule over it. Be reconciled and pursue love. You are here this morning. You need to be reconciled to your brother, or you need to be reconciled to God. I invite you to make that right. Included this time. Did we say stand and sing at the end? Stand and sing.